woman was startled when her building literally shook and quivered, and from nowhere, a brick came crashing through her window. She was convinced that the Federals were shelling Richmond. An elderly black man in a small home on 2nd Street was not so lucky. He died when another brick came hurtling through his rooftop and smashed his temple. So did a small black girl, whose faded dress was covered in red, caked with blood. And, too, an elderly gentleman at the American Hotel, who stubbornly refused to leave. His life ended, instantly, when a collapsing wall smothered him. In successive thrusts, the flames now spread. The few volunteer firemen who responded to calls found their fire hoses chopped to pieces by vengeful, pillaging mobs. So, block by block, the smoke, the heat, and the ash climbed, unimpeded. Meanwhile, out on the James River, the last of the Confederate Navy had abandoned their ironclad warships for wooden gunboats. Following orders, the metal ships had been packed with surplus artillery shells and then set to burn. The sailors were inching their way upriver under the fiery glow when the water, the city, and its seven hills suddenly shook and the sky exploded with tens of thousands of loaded combat shells and projectiles from the National Arsenal. The earth seemed to writhe as if in agony, one citizen noted fitfully. The house rocked like a ship at sea. This blast was uncontainable. It shattered plate glass windows blocks away, and that was only the start. Doors of houses were ripped off their hinges, chimneys spontaneously caved in, and the atmosphere was thick with the odor of smoke and heated air and burning brick. This blast was in turn followed by consecutive explosions that consumed three ironclads run aground on the James. Shells from the ships arced into the sky and returned to earth a fiery rain of debris. From their windows, Richmonders watched those silent, awful fires lap along their streets. Wrote Mary Fontaine, all like myself were watching them, paralyzed and breathless. Up to now, there had been no let-up from these hideous scenes, nor would this change. Wholly unanticipated, the Confederate shells, now exploding in full force, would continue to do so with clockwork regularity, for 4 hours running, minute after minute, hour after hour, bombarding the city. All told, 100,000 shells would go off, driving Richmonders to distraction. The deafening sounds, worse than an enemy siege, would have a powerful effect on everyone who heard them. Few who lived to tell the story would ever forget it. And not everyone would live. At the city almshouse near the river, scores of paupers had fled to a nearby hill. But as the hours passed, 11 of them, weak and shivering in their nightshirts, ignored warnings and returned inside, in search of blankets and better clothing. While some were simply climbing the front steps, the arsenal exploded, without interval or warning. There were no fire squads to come to their rescue, no good Samaritans to help them. The explosion engulfed them. No one survived. Then came another grim symbol of the night's events. At 5th and Main, residents watched in dumb horror as the spire of the United Presbyterian Church caught fire, swaying and tottering for some 60 minutes, until it fell, finally, and was no more. In the last horrid moments before light, the city seemed almost suspended in an eerie, unnerving stillness. And as dawn came, Richmonders realized that all the routine noises and customary sights that had for so long been an integral part of their Confederate lives, the incessant clanking of workers by the wharves, the rumbling of soldiers on foot and the constant ringing of bells, the clatter of official carriages and the high-pitched whistles of naval vessels, and, of course, the long brick skyline adorned by the stars and bars flying aloft, had changed, absolutely and seemingly forever. With numbed blank looks, more and more people, exhausted and frightened and heartbroken, picked their way outside. Before their very eyes, whole streets had seemingly disappeared, and against this strange shimmering glow in the sky, the wreckage of thousands of lives could now be revealed in vivid detail. The broken tables and chairs, the shattered dishes and scorched silver, the blackened tools and melted dolls, and the bonnets, everywhere the bonnets, strewn about on the sidewalks. Unknown to them, miles away in the distance, Richmond itself had disappeared, its hills and spires shrouded in smoke. For those who had succeeded in getting out in the nick of time, or who were uninjured, or who were fortunate enough to have a comfortable roof to sleep under, there was the incredible agony of remembering what they had seen, and not knowing what would become of others. And for those remaining, the worst horror was what the next few hours would bring. All that could be done was to wait. The sun rose, and the city's vistas were chilling. The fire still burned. Everywhere were broken houses, charred buildings, and dead animals lit by the infernal glow. Old businesses, fine hotels, elegant residences, newspapers, restaurants, all were destroyed by the indiscriminate inferno. True, many buildings still stood, a number of them the most handsome in the city. St. Paul's Church, for instance, was singed and blackened, but ultimately escaped burning, if only barely. So, too, the Executive Mansion, the oldest continually occupied governor's residence in America. Its house and kitchen both caught fire several times, but were saved at the last second by hand brigades working frenetically with buckets. Much of Richmond, however, was not so fortunate. Some 20 blocks lay in waste, a smoking, simmering ruin, forever thence to be known as the Burnt District. And the Mayo Bridge, the very last one standing, was jammed with tar-filled barrels in anticipation of its own approaching apocalypse. One officer, a South Carolinian, posted near the abutments, watched as the Confederate troops steadily trudged south. Finally, shortly after dawn, he rode over to the engineer who stood by, waiting, touched his hat, and reported, "All over, goodbye." Then he ordered, "Blow her to hell." Within an hour, the Confederacy's greatest indignity would begin. Richmond would be occupied territory. "A single blue jacket rose over the hill," recorded one Richmonder, standing transfixed with astonishment at what she saw. "Then another sprang up, and another, as if rising out of the earth." It was just shy of 7 a.m. Outside the city, Union troops were moving, slowly but painfully, fear in their faces in single file. The ground was so densely covered by enemy landmines that the soldiers were adhering to a little path marked out by wooden sticks and pieces of red webbing attached, which the Confederates, in their haste, had forgotten to dismantle. But beyond the minefields, scores of Union troops, including the all-black 25th Corps, were racing up the turnpikes and across unplanted fields to be the first to enter Richmond. And racing to meet them in a rickety carriage, flying a white flag, was a well-dressed 80-year-old man bearing the seal of the city in this terse message: "To the general commanding the United States Army in front of Richmond, I respectfully request that you will take possession of the city of Richmond with an organizing force to preserve order and protect women and children and property. Respectfully, Joseph Mayo, Mayor." Thus began what one Union soldier penned, a day never to be forgotten. However breathtaking the sight of Union columns advancing on Main Street may have been for the North, for Richmonders it was devastating. The long lines of artillery and cavalry moved, in the words of one Confederate, like a serpent through the streets. Surrounding the troops was what Major General Godfrey Weitzel, the Union commander in charge, would later call a yelling, howling mob of drunken residents, white and black, pillaging or bent on saving some little piece that remained. Weitzel plowed through the crowd up to Capitol Square. There, the scene was horrific, a calculus of squalor, despondency, and terror. The refugees were the worst sight. In the square itself, by the stately old brick bell tower, several hundred families had gathered beneath the hurling cinders, heated air, and flying pieces of burning wood. The elderly, the sick, women cradling infants, some holding young children by the hand, the rich and the destitute alike, all gaped in astonishment at the choking smoke, the flames now roaring out of control, and most of all, at the incoming Yankees. Evicted by the fire, these people were now homeless and penniless, left only with a few household items, a bit of bedding, cooking utensils, heirlooms and tintype photographs, a single bureau or chest, or even a sofa, gathered in haste and piled senselessly on the grass. But the Armageddon was not yet over. All around them, burning buildings threatened to collapse on both sides. Many did, falling into grisly heaps. By day's end, the initial estimates of damage could be tallied up. 900 homes and businesses destroyed. Hundreds more badly damaged. At least 54 blocks, virtually all gone. Richmond's charming enclaves, in ruins. In many cases, even old-line Richmonders could no longer tell which block was which. Now the refugees huddled and wept on the open lawn with scared, hungry children. It was, said the Union commander, a sight that would have melted a heart of stone. And even as more Richmonders stumbled up to the grassy flanks of the square, they could hear the ominous sound of military men maneuvering on the adjacent streets around City Hall, the thud of enemy feet on the pavement, the sharp commands ringing in the spring air. At exactly 8 o'clock, the Confederate flag that had fluttered above the Capitol came down, and the Stars and Stripes was run up. My heart sickened with indignation to think that we ever should have loved that flag, wept one woman. Another lamented, we covered our faces and cried aloud. All through the house was the sound of sobbing. It was as the house of mourning. While Union regimental bands played Yankee Doodle and the Star-Spangled Banner, and black and white troops marched up Main Street, most citizens quickly retreated to their homes, peering through drapes pulled tight. We tried to comfort ourselves by saying in low tones that the Capitol was only moved temporarily, one resident told herself, that General Lee would make a stand and repulse the daring enemy, and that we would win the battle and the day. Alas, alas for our hopes. In the days that followed, some women did venture forth, masking their emotions with exquisite politeness or barely restraining them behind clenched teeth. For hours, these women, ominously swathed in black as a sign of their mourning, drifted aimlessly through the streets of their ruined city, avoiding the gaze of Yankees, avoiding the United States flag, avoiding the dreaded blacks, now freed, coming their way on the sidewalk. Anything would be better, cried one woman, than to fall under the United States again. Bitterness lay as thick as the smoke and ash. Reporters struggled mightily to capture the pathos and mystique of a fallen Richmond for their northern readers. Wrote one New York Times correspondent, Richmond is indeed most beautiful, in spite of the hideous ruins left behind. It is a magnificent capital, both old world and new. I can scarcely record its splendor, built like a miniature Rome, upon a number of little hills. Strolling through Richmond at twilight, a reporter for the New York World put it this way. There is a stillness in the midst of which Richmond, with her ruins, her spectral roofs, and her unchanging spires, rest beneath a ghastly, fitful glare. We are under the shadows of ruins. From the pavements where we walk stretches a vista of devastation. The wreck, the loneliness seem interminable. There is no sound of life but the stillness of the catacomb, only as our footsteps fall dull on the deserted sidewalk and a funeral troop of echoes bump against the dead walls and closed shutters to reply, and this is Richmond. Says a melancholy voice, and this is Richmond. The North wisely sought to ease the pain of its occupation. Though martial law reigned, Union mechanics worked overtime to get the railroads functioning, a phalanx of federal work parties cleared the streets of debris and quelled the fires, and Yankee grocer confectioners provided rations for starving Richmonders. Nonetheless, relations remained tense, and, despite the Union's benign rule, few signs were auspicious for reconciliation. It is ultimately impossible for the people of the South to embrace the Yankees, editorialized the Richmond Whig on its last day of Confederate publication, even to recognize them as fellow creatures. An acre of blood separates us. In the days to come, that acre would widen. It would challenge Abraham Lincoln every bit as much as did the Confederate armies that still eluded him. As white Richmond retreated behind shutters and blinds, black Richmond spontaneously took to the streets. From the moment Union troops entered the city, Richmond at last, black Union cavalrymen shouted. Crowds, the skilled and the unskilled, household servants and household cooks, rented maids and hired mill workers, jammed the sidewalks to catch a glimpse of the spectacle. no longer enslaved, they thrust out their hands to be shaken or presented the soldiers with offerings, gifts of fruit, flowers, even jugs of whiskey. Federal officers riding alongside promptly reached for the liquor bottles and smashed them with their swords. But the crowd was undaunted. Just a day earlier, they had been prohibited from smoking, publicly swearing, carrying canes, purchasing weapons, or procuring ardent spirits. Yet now, to the sounds of John Brown's body, they jubilantly waved makeshift rag banners. To the tune of the battle hymn of the Republic, they enthusiastically hugged and kissed the bluecoats. For hours, ignoring the furnace-like heat and smoke-choked air, they lingered in the dusty streets as federal soldiers passed, bowing and giving thanks. The Yankees at last had gone and come! In the late morning, when black troops marched in lockstep, majestically and proudly defiant, in the words of an onlooker, they danced with unimpeded joy, and most of all, they praised God, shouting hallelujah, recalled one Connecticut soldier. Our reception was grander and more exultant than even a Roman emperor could ever know. Indeed, for the slaves who had long eavesdropped on parlor conversations or passed along snippets of war news gleaned from a trip to the store or post office, or who had listened month after month for the sounds of federal shells and wondered how long the Confederacy would last, this was surely the day of jubilo. What had been foretold in hundreds of secretly worded spirituals sung at dusk on thousands of plantations across the South had now finally come to pass. The euphoria was difficult for either side to fathom. Said one white Richmonder, our servants were completely crazed. They danced and shouted, men hugged each other and women kissed. Imagine the streets crowded with these people. A Union soldier seemingly concurred. The former slaves, he also wrote, were completely crazed. In these early heady moments, it was as if the Richmond heavens had been turned upside down. Not completely. For a number of the city's former slaves, the full implications of freedom were still unclear. All I know, it don't take no passes now to go around nowhere, one black man told a northern reporter. It didn't matter. The newly freed men and women would soon understand this. Finished were the days when women and girls would be tied to one another by ropes wound like harnesses around their necks. Never again would black men and boys wear heavy iron collars linked by a thick chain, their wrists cuffed behind their backs. No longer would Negroes be taken to large wooden blocks to be blithely auctioned off as property, just as farmers routinely sold cows, pigs, and horses. And never again would their condition resemble one grand menagerie where men are reared for the market like oxen for the shambles. Or, as one freed man put it, prosaically yet elegantly, bless God, the nigger's free. No more hoeing of corn for dis poor child, and no more lashes from dat cruel overseer. The feeling was not, however, entirely monolithic. For a complex host of reasons, some free blacks and former slaves readily identified with the Confederacy. Bound by time and familiarity and even affection, not all black servants openly reveled in their changed circumstances. Some even stayed with their former masters. I'm going to town to hunt my young mistress, said one. I'd risk my life to get her from dem terrible Yankees. But in the same breath, many openly gloated. Hello, massa, bomb rail on top this time, became the familiar saying. And in one far more telling instance, a committee of three former slaves bluntly informed their former owner that they were free, although they would work if paid in federal greenbacks. In these stirring, emotion-packed hours, there were also tender moments that transcended the high politics of emancipation and the gritty realities of a war that was still underway. Most memorable, perhaps, were those that involved the reunion of families wrenched apart by the slave trade. For many years, Virginia's Negroes had been eagerly sought along the Georgia and Mississippi frontiers. Between 1830 and 1840, no fewer than 117,000 Virginia slaves were sold to other states, often cruelly separating families. Father ripped from son, mother torn from daughter, brother taken from sister. and a special sense of anguish was reserved for those Negroes snatched by the most insidious freebooter of them all, the kidnapper. But as Richmond fell, parents were reunited with sons and daughters alike. In one heart-stopping case, a mother rejoined her son who had been missing for a staggering 2 decades. She wept. "This is your mother, Garland, whom you are now talking to, who has spent 20 years of grief about her son." The son and former slave whom she had found on the streets of Richmond was now the regimental chaplain of the United States Colored Troops. Among the many reporters from northern newspapers who sought to record the sights and sounds of this newfound freedom was one who was himself a searing symbol of the day. Writing under the nom de plume Rollin, he was actually T. Morris Chester, who sat at a desk in the former Confederate capital penning his dispatches to the Philadelphia Press. Of all the reporters now jostling about in Richmond to chronicle events for posterity, he was unique. Unusually cultured and urbane, he had been educated at elite schools in the rustic hills of Vermont, read law in London where he hobnobbed with British abolitionist circles, was filled with dash and bravado, and would at one time even be received by the Tsar of Russia. Calling America his home, he would also enigmatically emigrate for a time to Liberia. But on this day, he was in the former citadel of the Confederacy, and with his keen eye for detail and his passion for ending slavery, he neatly captured the emancipationist feelings with a stentorian voice few others could muster. He jotted, "Seated in the speaker's chair so long dedicated to treason, I hasten to give a rapid sketch of the incidents which have occurred." And then, "Richmond has never before presented such a spectacle of jubilee. What a wonderful change has come over the spirit of Southern dream." T. Morris Chester, of course, was the son of a former slave and the only black correspondent for a major daily paper in the North. The next day, April 4, brought an equally stunning sight. While General Grant was off in hot pursuit of Lee's army, President Abraham Lincoln, in a high silk hat and long black coat, landed at Rockets in the early afternoon and, accompanied by a naval guard of 10 sailors, 6 in front, 4 in the rear, set foot on Richmond's vaunted soil and began the nearly 2-mile walk up the hill to Capitol Square. But even 4 long years of continuing war had not prepared the lanky president for the unprecedented reception he was to receive along a simple 1-mile stretch. Out came a sound. "Glory to God!" It was a black man working by the dock. Then again, "Glory to God! Glory, glory, glory!" Leaving their squalid houses and their tar paper shacks, an impenetrable cordon of newly freed blacks followed Lincoln down the rubble-strewn streets, starting with a handful and swelling into 1,000. "Bless the Lord," they shouted, "the great Messiah. I knowed him as soon as I seed him. He's in my heart 4 long years. Come to free his children from bondage. Glory, hallelujah." And Lincoln replied, "You are free, free as air." "I know I am free," answered one old woman, "for I have seen Father Abraham and felt him." One of Lincoln's aides asked the mass to step aside and allow the president to proceed, but to no avail. "After being so many years in the desert without water," a man said happily, "it is mighty pleasant to be looking at last on our spring of life." Weeping for joy, they strained to touch his hand. Dizzy with exultation, they brushed his clothing to see that he was real. Fearing that it was only a dream, they wiped their tears to make sure they were in fact looking out upon his face. Moved, Lincoln ignored his bodyguards and waded deeper into the thickening flock. One black man, overcome by emotion, dropped to his knees, prompting the president to conduct a curbside colloquium on the meaning of emancipation. "Don't kneel to me," said the president. "That is not right. You must kneel to God only, and thank him for the liberty you will enjoy hereafter." And then Lincoln declared, "Let me pass on. I want to see the Capitol." As the party wound its way deeper through the tattered downtown streets, columns of smoke ominously billowed into the sky. Several buildings were still aflame, and Lincoln security men peered nervously at every window for would-be assassins. All around them was a strange, almost macabre quiet. There had been no official welcoming party to greet the chief executive of the United States, and now the crowd studying him from their windows did so in silence. There were no calls, no cheers. At one point, Lincoln's bodyguard, scanning the buildings, thought he saw the glint of a gun from a second-story window. Instantaneously, he stepped in front of the president. Lincoln pushed on, fanning himself in the lingering heat, while hundreds of white Richmonders, cloistered inside, continued to fix their gaze on the president. A cavalry escort took him the last few blocks to the rebel executive mansion, now a Union military headquarters. Inside, a pale and utterly worn-out Lincoln wandered around the deserted rooms. And then, a mere 40 hours after Jefferson Davis had left it, the President of the United States asked for a glass of water and sat down in the first floor study of the President of the Confederate States, while Union troops broke into cheers. "Thank God I have lived to see this," Lincoln had muttered earlier in the day. "It seems I have been dreaming a horrid dream for 4 years, and now the nightmare is gone." But not yet, and Lincoln knew it. Indeed, he would comment that his anxieties were so great that all he cared about was not how the Confederates were subdued, but that the work was perfectly done. Still, he wasted no time in laying the groundwork for eventual reconciliation. For one thing, the occupation of Richmond was not to be a repeat of Sherman's march to the sea, nor of Sheridan in the Shenandoah. Here, in the heart of Virginia, the most important state in the Confederacy, Lincoln saw to it that restraint was the watchword. The military stubbornly prohibited the use of offensive words or insulting gestures. There were no reports of Union rapes or burnings, no break-ins, no sacking of houses. When Mrs. Robert E. Lee, who was too stricken by arthritis to flee and thus remained in Richmond, suggested that the soldier posted on her doorstep, a black man, was perhaps an insult, she was promptly given a new guard, a white from Vermont, and had her household offer him meals on a tray. By design, Lincoln came as a peacemaker, noted his escort, Admiral David D. Porter, his hand extended to all who desired to take it. Porter hoped that Richmonders would see that Lincoln was not a monster, that there were no horns or hoofs, and that there was less of the devil about him than in Jeff Davis. But the national nightmare was still far from over. As far as Lincoln could tell, the bloodshed could go on for months, even longer, if not on an organized battlefield, then on deadly guerrilla terrain. His morose fears, so deep and ubiquitous, had not yet been addressed. He surely didn't want a repeat of the Wilderness Swings. He wanted Robert E. Lee. "I have got my army safely out of its breastworks," Robert E. Lee told an aide as he began to swing west to Amelia Courthouse, "and in order to follow me, the enemy must abandon his lines and can derive no further benefit from his railroads on the James River." On April 3, if Lee was disheartened, he was certainly not beaten. Freed of the yoke of Richmond, of maintaining his men in miles of dismal trenches, he was determined to rescue the South's battered and bloodied sons. For every mile that they crossed, Grant's supply lines would lengthen, and Lee's toward Danville would shorten. And now he was also relying on his old ally, the Virginia countryside, to help him escape. It would work like this. Each mile that his army advanced westward was a little denser, a little more precipitous, a little more hostile to the invading army. Though his men and his horses were tired, they would reach Amelia Courthouse by the next day. Though Grant had the inside track to Burkeville beyond Amelia, his arc would be 19 miles shorter than Lee's, Lee's men had a one-day jump on the Federals. And though Grant's cavalry was somewhere out sniping at the left flank of Lee's army by the night of the 3rd, Lee's men were in surprisingly good spirits. For one thing, they were certain of this. Once at Amelia, they could rest, catch a bit of sleep, and most importantly, eat a solid meal before moving on. And as they marched away from their trenches, Lee's hardy veterans, reassured by the imposing presence of their general-in-chief, were no less hopeful than he. War, for victors and losers alike, is invariably about a series of contingent ifs. The only thing certain about war is its uncertainty and unpredictability, as the master military theorist Karl von Clausewitz has reminded us. And, time and again, history has borne out Clausewitz. The English unexpectedly stymied the French at Agincourt. Napoleon succumbed to zeal in his long winter march on Russia and suffered dearly as a result. The Mexican general, Santa Anna, fell prey to overconfidence against a makeshift army of Texans and paid the price for it. After an 80-year siege, the Dutch Republic held off a far stronger Spanish enemy and finally gained its independence. And, of course, even George Washington had suffered defeat after defeat in New York and New England, in Georgia and South Carolina, before eventual triumph. The if now for Lee, given that his men were subsisting on the meagerest of rations, was that everything depended on a speedy and uninterrupted retreat. Lee's pace was unrelenting. Groping forward at an astonishing clip of 21 miles per day over rough and unforgiving terrain, Lee had some reason for qualified optimism. Indeed, on this day, while Richmond still smoldered and Union soldiers cheered, a curious, even mystical spirit, half of elation, half of frenzied, unconquerable faith, spread throughout the Confederate ranks. And to those men watching Lee, sitting erect on his horse, looking anything but demoralized, the general exuded good humor and seemed confident that Johnston's army was within reach. Chapter 3. The Chase and the Decision. To the contemporary mind, it is difficult to contemplate the westward march of the Army of Northern Virginia, and just as difficult to step outside all the history that has come after. In contrast with military campaigns across the most recent century, an extended troop march appears to be almost an anachronism. Today, great military machines race across terrain in high-speed tanks and armored personnel carriers, or, more and more, jet overhead by cargo plane, unless they are poorly equipped or take to the ground for surprise, or because the battlefield has collapsed around them. They do not march on foot, and, if they do, they certainly do not expect grand victory. It is perhaps no accident that one of the most famous military marches of the 20th century was neither a strategic retreat nor a tactical feint, both of which were part of Robert E. Lee's stock in trade, but something very different, a journey into captivity known as the Bataan Death March, made over 10 days and 75 miles by 36,000 already defeated American servicemen in the Philippines. Even now, Bataan, where upward of 10,000 men died of thirst, exhaustion, beatings, torture, or beheadings, is a march that skews and defines much of the modern military imagination. But Robert E. Lee was not of a 20th century mind. The marches he knew were not Bataan, but heroic efforts made by indomitable men like Hannibal, Alexander the Great, and Napoleon, for whom the distinction between military genius and reckless insanity was often measured by the razor-thin line of success. People must have thought Hannibal especially crazy, setting out from Spain with 40,000 men and an ungodly number of elephants to traverse two hazardous mountain ranges, the Pyrenees and the Alps, and a deep rushing river, the Rhone, and to endure landslides, blinding snowstorms, and attacks by hostile mountain tribes. They thought him crazy, that is, until he did it in 15 days and swept down upon the unsuspecting Romans. And even Napoleon's ill-fated march was less a cautionary tale than an object lesson, for when the 600,000 French forces lunged into Russia, it was the retreating Russians who had simply faded away in front of them, drawing the overconfident French ever further into a harsh and unforgiving land. Now Lee and his veterans, some 35,000 men, had a roughly 140-mile march to make and a solid 12 to 24-hour lead. And, like the wily Russians, if necessary, they too could seek to melt away from Grant's legions of materiel and men. To be sure, Lee understood the odds, but ever the gambler, hadn't he bested them before? Hadn't he gotten to Cold Harbor first? Then, hadn't he held Richmond and Petersburg longer than most would have imagined? To leave Grant behind now would almost certainly enshrine him among history's great commanders and tacticians. But it would all come down to fate and execution. And as April 3 dawned, the signs of progress were still promising. It was happening like this. Four broad columns of troops had poured out of the trenches and fortifications around Richmond and Petersburg and were anxiously streaming toward Amelia Courthouse, which lay below a river bend. Almost unnoticed among the miles of stars and bars, it was pitch black, was Lee himself. A top traveler, he had posted himself at a fork in the road, and for hours, man and horse directed traffic until the last of the troops had filed past. Three of the contingents were to cross the Appomattox River en route to Amelia. The fourth, already south of the river, would simply continue west. Once they reunited, they would quickly eat, rest, and regroup, then turn south to Danville, and then across the North Carolina border to Joe Johnston. After they reached Amelia, moreover, the route would likely favor Lee's men. Union troops, in February, had themselves already probed a number of these backcountry roads and declared them the worst possible. It was, of course, on these familiar roads that Lee and his army were now marching. This is not to say the obstacles weren't considerable. By day, they fled along packed roads and stubby rural cut-throughs that necessitated traversing swollen, difficult streams and scaling high-sloping ridges. Sometimes the roads were open and expansive, but other stretches were far less hospitable, winding through uncut acres of scrub brush and pine that tore at and scratched their skin, their passage so narrow in spots that a single artillery wagon could barely slide past. Where they could, the men stepped around rocks and ruts. Where they could not, they simply went over or through them. At night, with little sleep and even less respite, the men continued to march under the cover of darkness. On and on, hour after hour, from hilltop to hilltop, for the better part of two solid nights and one continuous day, they struggled to keep their lead. By April 4, they were dirty, unwashed, mud-splattered, exhausted, and most of all, desperately hungry. Their bread was gone, and so was their meat. Still, after months of languishing in the trenches, their morale and elan were surprisingly strong, and at the thought of food and Amelia, so were their spirits. And, too, they were comforted by this. Once replenished, their lead over Grant solidified, they would complete their dash to safety. So what mattered now was each new stride, each new landmark, bringing them closer to the 350,000 rations they expected at Amelia Courthouse, and taking them a step farther away from Grant's huge force, eagerly trailing behind. Under the blanket of stars and into the blistering heat of midday, and back again under the shelter of night, the men rushed ahead. But U.S. Grant was not so forgiving. Already, there were signs of growing peril. In the rear of the retreat, low-level skirmishing raged like an ongoing battle. At Sutherland Station, the fighting was so fierce that a nearby house had to be requisitioned for a makeshift hospital, its doors ripped off their hinges to serve as stretchers for the wounded. The next day, the battle grew down the road, at Namazine Church, where Federal cavalry set upon trailing rebels. Lee's own riders repulsed the enemy, but not without a price. A number of rebels were cut to pieces, and while Grant's men had been stung, they were heartily vanquished. Regrouping, they prepared to plunge ever deeper into Lee's lines. But the bulk of Lee's forces were still well ahead, and Federal cavalry was not Federal infantry. The latter would always be slower in coming. Indeed, Lee and his staff even felt comfortable enough to accept a leisurely dinner invitation from Judge James Cox at his house, Clover Hill. But with Grant's forces in pursuit, the commanding general didn't want to press his luck. Thus, he did not stay the night, instead hurrying forward to make the Appomattox crossing. By morning, he expected to be in Amelia. Once more, however, there was trouble. Lee's plans had called for his vast columns of men and materiel to cross over three separate bridges. But one of them, Bevel's Bridge, was washed out. At another, Janito Bridge, the materials to shore it up had never arrived. Lee improvised. In the first case, three separate corps, Gordon's, Longstreet's, and Mahone's, were densely wedged onto a single bridge. For the second, the Confederates found a nearby railway pass that they neatly planked over. These delays, costing the Confederates in manpower, in stamina, and most precious of all, in ticks of the clock, held up the completion of the crossing until the following evening. But they were hardly fatal, for now, the rebels continued to retain their lead. There was little reason to believe this would change. Managing the retreat, the stoic Lee himself made it across the Appomattox only on the morning of April 4 at 7:30 a.m. Like his men, he had scarcely slept since leaving Petersburg and Richmond. But this morning his hopes, and theirs, rose at the stirring thought of the relief waiting for them in Confederate boxcars on the Danville line at Amelia. Here would be the sorely needed rations. Several hours later, around midday, Amelia itself came into view, a sleepy village of unpaved streets, with houses neatly tucked behind tumbled roses and weathered fences, and a few small shops converging around a grassy square. Lee raced ahead. His overarching interest was not the scenery but the rail line, where he would find the waiting commissary stores and the much-needed food. Upon locating the boxcars, he ordered them to be opened. This is what he found. 96 loaded caissons, 200 crates of ammunition, 164 boxes of artillery harnesses, but no bread, no beef, no bacon, no flour, no meal, no hardtack, no pork, no ham, no fruit, no cornmeal, and no milk, no coffee, no tea, no sugar, not one single ration. Lee was stunned. Ammunition, but no food? He was coordinating a massive retreat, holding his army together, keeping the Union at bay while maintaining almost a day's lead on the brunt of Grant's men. And as he had carefully planned, his troops were successfully reuniting at Amelia. But now, a mere administrative mix-up, over food no less, threatened to do him in. In that one tortuous moment, Lee was speechless. Yet standing there, staring at the wrong train, he could not mask the intense agony written all over his face. Even as he straightened his broad shoulders, the catastrophic news had shaken the commander to his very depths. Well, it should have. Lee knew that the implications were as staggering as they were immediate. His men had left Richmond and Petersburg with only one day of rations. That day had come and gone, and much more hard marching lay ahead of them. If the army wasn't fed, it could literally starve. Already, weakened men and animals were slowly dropping in their tracks. But to eat now meant halting the march to find food, which meant squandering his priceless lead over Grant. And in either case, there was no guarantee that he would secure food that day, the next, or the next after that. Wars can turn on such seemingly minor things. A clerk's careless error, a 5-minute delay in sending a communique, or a failure to have one clear order reconfirmed. But near-fatal errors have played unexpected roles in history before. Great men, and certainly great generals, find ways to overcome obstacles, rather than to find excuses to be thwarted by them. They may command, but they may never complain, even when luckless. And somehow, they move on. So it was for the resolute Lee. Halting was out of the question. Nor was this merely soldierly vanity or military stubbornness. Lee knew, too, that if fate and luck had betrayed him here, they might well do the same to his foe. Anything could still happen. Given time and the worst possible roads, Grant could stumble, or get overconfident, or succumb to sloppiness. Or like A.P. Hill, he could suddenly fall prey to an errant bullet. Or like Stonewall Jackson, he could fall victim to friendly fire in the heat and smoke of a skirmish. But now, Lee's first priority was his army. The general wasted little time, quickly giving the bad news to his division commanders and then writing out an appeal to the citizens of Amelia County, in which he called on their generosity and charity, and asked them to supply as far as each is able the wants of the brave soldiers who have battled for your liberty for 4 years. Then he waited. From afternoon well into the night, thousands of hungry men, their bellies growling, converged upon the little town, all bewildered by the lack of food. But that evening, as Lee rode past the Second Corps, the troops let out a lusty cheer, throwing up their hands, shouting and waving. It was a small signal, but an important one nonetheless. His men may have lacked food, but they certainly still had heart. These veterans were hardly giving up. But as they fell asleep once again on empty stomachs, Lee well knew that heart alone would not allow them to continue. As dawn broke on April 5, he received his answer. The situation was ugly. The citizens of Amelia County had already been cleaned out by Confederate impressment crews and the exigencies of war. Lee's forage wagons came back virtually empty. There were no pigs, no sheep, no hogs, no cattle, no provender. And there would be no breakfast that morning for the men. Growing increasingly anxious, Lee knew that his only option now was to rouse his army and begin a hard, forced march toward Danville, where 1.5 million rations were stored. It was 104.5 miles by railroad, 4 grueling days by foot, but he calculated this time could be whittled down to only 1 day if rations were rushed forward by train to Burkeville, a mere 18 miles down the line. Lee dispatched an order by wire. Would it work? Just as he could no longer wait in Amelia for rations, no longer could he wait for an answer. With the buffer of the Appomattox River gone and crucial hours lost, Grant's men were now dangerously closing in. There was no time to waste. It was, in fact, worse than Lee realized. Lee and his generals already knew the price that Union raiders had been exacting with their slashing hit-and-run strikes along the rear of the retreating Confederate lines. So stinging and furious were the Union assaults that the rebels could not stop even to bury their dead. But they had at least been confined to the rear. Now, however, some 7 miles northwest of Amelia Courthouse, Federal cavalry had destroyed Confederate supply wagons arriving from Richmond, and they had not simply absconded with the material, they had ignominiously burned it, leaving behind charred wrecks that littered the ground. The Union was drawing closer. Lee hastily mounted Traveler and immediately ordered his men to move toward Burkeville. It was early morning, April 5. A cold, hard rain began to fall over the empty Virginia land. Sometime after 1 o'clock that afternoon, Lee learned that the race had tightened. Just outside Jetersville, itself a ragtag town consisting of little more than a collection of weathered wooden houses scattered alongside the rail line, Union cavalry had beaten the rebels to the punch. Earthworks were blocking the retreat path like a dam. Battle flags had been raised, and well-fed bluecoats were peering over the lines. Dug in, thick and high, the Federals were waiting. Earlier, one of Lee's key lieutenants, General Longstreet, had already sought to dislodge them. Convinced that it was only cavalry in the way, he briskly attacked. It was indeed Federal cavalry, he discovered, but with one crucial difference. Sheridan's horsemen were now backed by 2 Federal corps strung out between Lee and North Carolina. The road of escape, through Burkeville, had been cut off. Lee, however, would not be denied, at least not at first. Riding down the retreat line, he cast a sidelong glance, lifted his field glasses, and gazed out at the freshly dug Union fortifications. His latest plans thwarted, he wasted no time in licking his wounds. For several tense moments, he considered one last massive and final assault, in which his men would be faced with winning a crushing victory or dying heroically with their flags down. But however tempting, such thoughts were ultimately built on vanity and shifting sands, and Lee knew it. The Union troops were too well entrenched, and his army was in no condition for an all-out battle. So, instead, Lee quietly opted to set his men back in motion again, this time due west for Lynchburg. Thus was delivered what many regimental commanders considered to be the most cruel marching order that they had ever given. To grasp the full horror of the march, it is necessary to make it yourself. The landscape constantly changes. Open fields are exasperatingly punctuated by high hedges and dense windbreaks that are impossible to see through or over or around. On the other side, they seamlessly merge into swamps or dense claustrophobic woods or undergrowth so thick as to be a second forest, all but impassable. Or conversely, they run into long, muddy tracks known euphemistically as Virginia quicksand. Once more, Lee pushed his men to the outer limits of human endurance. "I know that the men and animals are exhausted," he bluntly told one of his generals, "but it is necessary to tax their strength." And remarkably, once more they complied. Wagons bounced along the rutted roads, and the ground burned beneath soldiers' aching feet. Damp from the day's rain, their senses numbed from too little nourishment, they stumbled along with scarcely a word of complaint. But by now, they were fighting a second struggle, this one from within. The dreadful consequences were inevitable. Without food and deprived of sleep, the body begins to feed on itself, consuming vital muscle, raping invaluable tissue, robbing itself of what little energy is left. At the precipice of bare sustenance, thoughts become woozy, some experience a lightheadedness, others even hallucinate. And with each hour, the situation worsens. Initiative is deadened, and judgment becomes impaired, giving many the mental capacity of a small child. The elements, too, the sun, the wind, and the rain, become merciless. So does thirst. Limbs struggle to obey the simplest motor commands, and each step is like hauling oneself up a mountain. Yet somehow, Lee's men inched forward. How did they do it? After Amelia, what sustained them? In part, they rose to their feet because there was no other option. To be left behind was perhaps to be captured, or to die. But this is at best an incomplete explanation. A better one is that these were also not just the hardiest of Lee's veterans. Like their leader, they, too, were nourished with an iron discipline, even as they were fueled by the last legs of adrenaline. Like Lee, these men were not quitters. And foremost, also like Lee, they believed not only in their commanding general, but in their cause. It is a staggering fact that of the several thousand Confederate soldiers taken prisoner by the Federals after the Battle of Five Forks on April 1, not even a full 100 would swear the oath of allegiance to the Union. Even when promised release and safe passage home, they refused, bitterly cursing those cowards and traitors who would raise their hands or sign their names. But unless they ate, moving at this grueling pace, their life expectancies could be measured in days and, for some men, in mere hours. As they marched, the Army of Northern Virginia tore branches off trees, fitfully gnawed at wild buds, or even peeled and ate the bark itself. Every sudden halt saw a new round of men, like dim purgatorial souls, pitifully sink to their knees, or senselessly wander off in search of food or the restful escape of a long, deep sleep. Artillery mules collapsed, forgotten, and roads turned liquid by the rain. Wagons slid into muddy ruts and abruptly halted, sunk axle-deep and waterlogged, too heavy for the malnourished horses to pull them. They were summarily abandoned. And weary men discarded their weapons so as to have only themselves to drag along. In every direction, the dead, men, mules, and horses began to litter the roadside. Dense columns of smoke rose from exploding vehicles, and shells burst after being touched by flames. "It was now a race for life or death," one soldier concluded. Indeed it was. Following alongside, Lee learned from two captured Federal spies that the Union was gaining ground. He pushed his men that much harder. Nighttime fell. It didn't matter. morning now seamlessly intermingled with evening, darkness with sunset, breakfast with dinner, the 5th of April with the 6th, 2 hours with 8 hours, 8 hours with 16 hours, and eventually 24 hours with 40 hours. Hungry, with barely one night of rest in 3 days, many of the men wandered forward in a giddy, phantasmagoric state, slipping in and out of sleep in confusion as they walked. The evening was a little better. As the long black night wore on, more troops fell by the wayside. They would halt for a few moments' rest and fail to rise, their dazed eyes gazing haplessly at Lee's line, still lumbering west. One commander pronounced it an evening of gloomy silence. Actually, it was more than that. At this point, marching for yet another night under the cover of darkness, the retreat had become a confused, tangled skein. Always in the western direction, at various points the passage led northward, southward, and for brief spurts, paradoxically eastward, now often following the longer route rather than the shorter one. Little streams suddenly posed formidable obstacles. Flimsy pole bridges often had to be repaired, consuming invaluable hours and energy. Jagged rocks, fallen branches, and even small stones tripped up weary and blistered feet. The men moved on with sad glances and few words. And to complicate matters, since Deatonville, there were not enough roads leading west to absorb the tens of thousands of soldiers and hundreds of guns and wagons. A network of parallel roads had collapsed into one single dirt lane. Here, men and wagons and animals, moving at a testudinal pace, were thickly sandwiched in between, like debris trapped in a narrow, sluggish stream. And most ominous of all for Lee, the approaching high hills and thick pine woods, daunting for the hardiest of men, now favored Grant's offensive, and not his retreat. It was, in one historian's words, just the setting for a military tragedy. The toll itself began to wear on Lee. Still outwardly calm, his face nonetheless looked sunken, haggard, his resolution waning. In truth, though, it wasn't. For one thing, as far as he knew, the essential fact of his retreat had not yet unalterably changed. He still harbored hopes of dropping down to North Carolina beyond the Roanoke River. For another, there was suddenly the prospect of food to spur his men on. That afternoon, he'd learned that more than 80,000 rations of meal and bread, and even such delicacies as French soup packaged in tin foil along with whole hams, were definitively waiting in Farmville, 19 miles away. So, it was in that direction that the Confederates picked up their step and began again, in one long, snaking line to move. For his part, Grant was wasting no time. This was the opportunity that he had hoped for. But, summoned to Jetersville by Phil Sheridan, the Union commander now flirted with potential disaster. With only a handful of staff and 14 cavalry, he took off through hostile country, riding for 16 miles in the dark along unsecured roads. This meant that for several hours, some 12 times longer than at the start of Cold Harbor, perhaps more than 4 times as long as it took for A.P. Hill to be killed, he was out of contact not just with his own commanders, but with most of his army as well. However, even as Lee's luck seemed to turn against him, Grant's seemed to be holding. Sheridan's cavalry and 3 infantry corps continued to race alongside the retreating rebels, bludgeoning them with sledgehammer blows and quick in-and-out lightning attacks that heightened fatigue and panic. Fueled by the prospect of victory, the Federals had at long last begun to show a fighting spirit that had been sorely lacking since the Grant-Lee slugfest began almost a year before. Gone were the shock and dread of another Wilderness or Cold Harbor. No longer did they fear seeing the elephant of battle. It showed in their very stamina. Union men, despite their own obvious exhaustion, now seemed incapable of straggling, some handily marching upward of 35 miles per day. And it showed in their fighting, too. Accordingly, once safely at Jetersville, Grant caught the first scent of victory, It was, however, just that, a scent. After the carnage of the last year, he knew better than to take Lee for granted. "Lee's surely in a bad fix," he announced. "But if I were in his place, I think I could get away with part of the army." Then he added tantalizingly, "I suppose Lee will." That, of course, was precisely what he wanted to avoid. Meeting with Sheridan and Major General George Meade, he now reiterated his central plan. He did not want to follow Lee. He wanted to get ahead of him. Playing for keeps, this time Grant refined his stratagem. At dawn the next day, April 6, he dispatched Sheridan on a northwest swing, no longer aimed at Lee's rear, but intended to move ahead of him, directly positioning the hot breath of Union armies against Lee's face. For good measure, he ordered another infantry corps to join the push in the rear, completing the pincer movement. But by all accounts, there was still fight in the half-starved rebels yet. Even Grant himself recognized this. There was, he later acknowledged, as much gallantry displayed by some of the Confederates in these little engagements as was displayed at any time during the war. Nor did he overstate. Sweaty, exhausted, and famished beyond belief, even now the fleeing Confederates were in no mood to capitulate. As one crusty Confederate, a Yale man, jauntily sneered, "Over, sir? Over? Why, sir, it's just begun. We are now where many of us have longed to be. Richmond gone, nothing to take care of, foot loose, and, thank God, out of these miserable lines. Now we may get what we have wanted for months, a fair fight in open field. Let them come on, if they're ready, and the sooner the better." Come they did. On April 6th, after Deatonville, after the Confederates had turned right at a fork in the road, along a cold, obscure stream called Sailor's Creek. The skirmishing at Sailor's Creek, across three separate battle sites that would eventually merge into one, began early that day and mounted as the sun climbed. At Hillsman House, a little Revolutionary-era farm home high atop a bluff, it sits there still, a Confederate matron frantically passed out ash cakes from her basement to starving soldiers until her house was quickly overrun by Federals. The battle itself began in earnest by the first brush of afternoon, when two dangerous gaps appeared in Lee's lines, in the middle and near the front. Deadly Federal horsemen, swinging sabers and led by the dashing yellow-haired general, George Armstrong Custer, rushed in through the holes. Soon, three Union corps had cut off a quarter of Lee's army. Their guns shattered the unearthly silence of the rolling hills. A row of artillery batteries followed, decking Confederates who had been lingering on the dank and muddy swale. "I had seldom seen a fire more accurate, nor one that had been more deadly," one rebel noted. Off balance from lack of food, dazed by lack of sleep, the rebels were at first stunned, then, as one Confederate put it, they blanched, and finally, they were awestruck. Sheridan wasted no time in capitalizing on their diminished state. "Go through them," he shouted angrily. "They're demoralized as hell." Not completely. At the sight of the Yankees, they rallied. Rebel batteries swung into position, anchored their lines, and trained their barrels on the advancing Federals, while infantry crouched and pointed muskets at the enemy. It was only a prelude to fighting that would outdo much of the rest of the war in its savagery. One Union soldier recorded it this way. "The bullets began to fall as hailstones around us. Then, the bullets fell thicker and faster. Then, the leaden missiles were as thick as mosquitoes. Then, came the horror of stepping on the wounded. And then, when I felt a dull blow in the neighborhood of my left hip, I realized I was shot." The slopes were now rife with a smell of powder and smoke and cries of terror. After the methodical rebel order of fire, the line of advancing bluecoats wavered and broke. The first crisis was apparently over. But then, without warning, the conflict degenerated and the insensate killing began. Vaunted rebel discipline collapsed, and the hollow-eyed Confederates sprang to their feet with empty muskets, starting after the retreating Yankees. Catching up to the Federals, they became entangled in vicious hand-to-hand combat. Men struck one another with bayonets, flogged one another with the butts of guns, and flailed at one another with their feet. I well remember the yell of demonic triumph with which that simple country lad clubbed his musket and whirled savagely upon another victim, observed one commander, and that was merely the beginning. Grabbing one another with dirt-sodden fingers,